Hello. Welcome to the kickoff session of the 8th Annual Boston Book Festival. I'm Debbie Porter. I'm the founder and executive director of the Boston Book Festival. It's lovely to see you all here.
Thank you.
I'm delighted that you've chosen to spend your evening with three of the most exciting writers working today, Emma Donoghue, Maria Semple, and Tom Perata. I want to thank the Hachette Book Group for sponsoring this session. Both Emma and Maria are published by Hachette, and I know that when the session is over, you'll all want to go across the hall to the Gordon Chapel, where all three authors will be signing books. Special thanks to our presenting partner, WBUR 90.9 FM, Boston's NPR news station. It's a joy and a privilege to work with everyone at WBUR, and tonight we're lucky to have with us the fabulous Robin Young, the host of Here and Now. Many of WBUR's on-air talent will be at the festival tomorrow hosting sessions, and including Robin, who's going to come back and moderate the session, having presence and being present with Amy Cuddy and Sherry Turkle. So one more quick thing before I turn it over to Robin. Here you see a lovely, brand new red Vespa. And tomorrow afternoon, someone's going to win that Vespa, and it could be you. We are raffling the Vespa. We're selling tickets only tonight and tomorrow at the festival, so your chances of winning are actually pretty good. Tickets are $10. You can buy a ticket and fill it out while you're waiting in line to have your book signed. Thank you in advance for your support. All proceeds go to benefit the Boston Book Festival. And now it is my great pleasure to welcome Robin Young.
Thank you, Deb. Boy, what a wonderful, wonderful place to talk about books. And welcome, as Deb said, to the 2016 Book Festival, or as we've been referring to it, oh my God, thank God we don't have to talk about the campaign for several hours. I know. I thought we'd just flesh out a little bit these fabulous, as I've been saying in my tweets, this frappin' great lineup we have here tonight. This is just like having to read these books. The privilege of reading these books, it was just like having a fabulous meal. So let's just remind ourselves, though, because we know we have huge fans of the authors here, but we have Emma Donoghue. There are many in this room who understand that's the proper pronunciation of her name. Emma Donoghue, author of Room, the story of a five-year-old boy and his mother locked up in an underground shed by a terrible captor. It was made into an Oscar-nominated film. Brie Larson won Best Acting Oscar for her role as the mom. Emma was nominated for Best Writing for Adapted Screenplay. Her new book, The Wonder, also just a tender, gripping story that takes us into another room in Ireland where a young girl is also confined. But very different story. Is she a walking miracle who went without food for months, as her Catholic family and supporters believe, or is she now starving to death and hiding a terrible secret? And who will rescue her from that room? So that's Emma's new book. Please welcome individually Emma Donoghue. Next to me, Maria Semple. She's been getting raves for her new book. Today will be different, the story of Eleanor Flood, a formerly famous animator of a hit TV show now living ambivalently in Seattle. All of your characters live ambivalently in Seattle. With her famous hand surgeon husband, and of course, Maria's previous book, the bestseller, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? The story of a formerly famous Los Angeles architect married to a famous Microsoft guru who disappears, leaving her husband and daughter to find her. Maria is also a television writer. Her credits include Mad About You, Suddenly Susan, Arrested Development. And yet I read that she was hesitant at first to take on the screenplay for Bernadette, so we're going to ask her about that. But please welcome Maria Semple. And Tom Perata, who we've been on a couple of these panels together, so I simply say Tom Parada, who's in my colleague Chris Ballman's poker club. But perhaps we should add to that. His novel, The Leftovers, of course, was the terrific HBO series. I think I've been reading that all of your novels and two of your short story books have been optioned for the screen. Have I got that right?
Only one story collection.
Only one story collection.
Still available.
Still, we could sell it by the end of the night. All six of his novels have been optioned, and he's at hand in every screenplay of his books but one, Election, with Reese Witherspoon. That, of course, the high school election that went off the rails. Also author of 2004's Little Children, the story of the darkly comic goings-on in, a lot of us thought it was Belmont, but a suburb somewhere. And then again, The Leftovers, which he helped adapt as a series for HBO. Millions of people around the world who vanish, poof, they're gone. And what happens after that? Please welcome Boston's own Tom Parada. Tom, I want to start with you because we're talking about storytelling for page and screen, and you have thrown yourself vigorously into the screen part of this, even when it was just really did not seem to go your way. So let's start with 1997's novel, The Wishbones, coming-of-age story about a guy in a band. You had 16 interested buyers. It was like the world was your oyster, and then...
And then people heard of some movie called The Wedding Singer.
The Wedding Singer, yes.
Which... you know, only resembled the Wishbones in that there was a wedding band. But that's enough. It was the wedding band appeared in the one line description of each project. And so everybody, you know, Adam Sandler was this monstrous figure in the pop culture world at that time, and he just took over the idea.
Even though you had these young guys, I think Matt Damon, Ben Affleck, had done an early draft. Then what happened there?
They got famous.
Yes. And off they went.
Off they went. And then Noah Baumbach also had a hand in that. It's been optioned probably five or six times over the years.
For those who think that, oh, you write the book, and the book is, a bestseller, and then all these people flock around you. I mean, how long on average does it take you? And how often, you know, how rare is it that it actually goes from the book to the screen?
So the one... interesting rule for me is if it happens, it happens fast, and if it happens slow, it will never happen. Though that is not people can point to exceptions to that, the book that took 10 years to reach the screen, but Election went from, you know, my desk to, it was sat in my drawer for many years, but when it finally got to Alexander Payne, it took about a year.
Yeah.
And Little Children the same.
Yeah. We're going to get advice from you for people out here, you know, who wanting to know how do you make that happen. But first, Emma, for you, and you took on the writing of this book Room, which is just extraordinary. It's told mostly from the point of view of the five-year-old.
Entirely from the five-year-old, yeah.
And yet the movie, suddenly you have the mom point of view. So how did you go about getting your book to the screen?
Well, as soon as I sold the novel, I had a feeling there was going to be some interest in filming it, and I didn't want anyone to come along and offer me some fabulous deal involving some famous screenwriter because I wanted to write it. So I just went ahead and drafted a spec script, before publication of the book, you know, while I was still private with it. And I know that's a mad way to proceed. It's very unprofessional. But if you're a beginner in a trade, you could afford to act in an unprofessional and amateurish way. So then I waited, and lots of people approached me, and none of them seemed right, so I just said no to all of them. And after a while, my partner said to me, "Are you going to say yes to anyone?" And I said, "Not necessarily, because I don't want a bad film made of this." And then I waited a while, and the right director came along, and I knew he was the right director, because although I'd never heard of him, he wrote me a 10-page letter in which he not only described everything about his response to the book, you know, and like he picked up my Plato reference. I could tell he was a smart reader, but also he described the film he would make of it, and that corresponded very closely to the film I wanted made of it, so I knew that he was right. So I think the one very smart thing I did was to wait for the right director and only sell it to him.
Well, and you also, in the beginning, if I read this correctly, you thought, okay, I'm going to write a screenplay, so I will go get those screenplay writing books.
Oh, yeah, I got about 30 books from my local university library, and I sort of tried to, you know, learn the skills, and I was alarmed by their kind of doctrinaire tone. You know, they said things like, climax on page 60. You know, they spell things out in a way. I've never been told rules of writing novels in that way. And they said things like, get into a scene late and get out early. You know, there seemed a tone of ruthless efficiency to it all. So I tried to apply some of these rules. And then once I was actually working with our wonderful director, Lenny Abramson, he was like, oh, forget the rules. I don't think he ever said the word climax to me. Many of the things that I had already changed to make it more of an efficient vehicle, you know, he was like, oh no, let's go back to the book. So I found working with him a lot less rigid than attempting to apply the rules of screenwriting.
Yeah. Well, and I'm thinking of Maria, who of the three of you, you had done the most writing for the small screen for television, but you'd done the most writing. And yet after Bernadette, which was, if you haven't read this book, it's magnificent. And I'm one of the people who can't wait to see the movie. It was, you know, considered one of the best books of its year, bestseller. But you hesitated. You weren't sure you could take this book. Explain, if they haven't read the book, explain some of the unique features of it. It had, like, emails in it and FBI reports. And you thought, maybe I can't do this initially.
Right. It's an epistolary novel. And so it was told in a very broken-up form. You know, I've never counted the number of voices. In fact, once when I was trying to get to sleep, I thought I'd count the number of voices and where'd you go, Bernadette, but it just got me very wound up. But let's call it 50 voices. It really is a lot. And so what's interesting about it, I'm so fascinated by Emma's answer because I really come from the screenwriting way of looking at story, you know, and to me, where'd you go, Bernadette, actually, the story itself is a very solid, almost cinematic story, you know, if you take out the form of it. But there's a huge flashbacks, and I just felt like in order to adapt it, I'd have to cut out 50% of it at least. And I had a good career as a screenwriter, and I liked it, but I left. I moved to Seattle, ambivalently, apparently. There's something about it that tells me that I'm ambivalent about it. And so I thought that I wrote this novel, and it never really occurred to me that it would be made into a movie or that there would be interest in it in a movie. You know, one of the things that I get frustrated by, I don't know if both of you feel this way, but a lot of times when people say, when you are writing the novel, they say, oh, were you thinking about the movie? Or who are you thinking of who's going to play
most
your
irritating
part?
Question.
Yeah, it's the most irritating question because you just think, I should be so lucky if I have the brain width to think about the movie. You're really just trying to get the book written, which is so hard and so complex.
And also, can I just say, books are just as good.
Yes.
Books are just as important.
Yes.
No, well,
I'd say better.
Books are often better.
Yeah, better. I'll say just better, hands down. You know, so it is kind of an insult. But then I felt like to do Bernadette, it would almost be like trying to sneak in the back door of a industry that I left with a certain amount of dignity out the front door. You know, I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to kind of use this to get back into the screenwriting world. And so I felt like it was someone else's problem.
Yeah.
And I knew that writers don't get treated well, which is, I don't know if my esteemed guests, fellow panelists believe this, but I mean, my experience is that writers don't get treated well, and I thought...
Is that yours, you guys?
I was treated really well.
Yes.
But really, we made an indie movie, and then it got distributed as if it was a proper studio movie, but the actual making of it was like a couple of us around a kitchen table, so I had a lovely time, which is completely untypical of the industry.
That's right, and I people like me hear about Emma's story, and it's just like we don't even believe
Sickening.
It. We think, yeah, it's just like, wait, what? Yeah, you can't believe that it went off so well and she got treated so well. So I just didn't want to go through that process of a writer to get treated badly on a movie.
Well, but how do you want to characterize this? You did make a stab at right.
Yeah, so they hired some writers, and then that script didn't really come together, and then I took a crack at it, and I was actually very happy with my script, but then we were lucky enough to get Richard Linkletter interested in it, and he always writes his own stuff and starts from scratch, and so he just started over and wrote his own script, which is terrific, and so I got saved from the development process, and he's been wonderful and wrote a terrific script, and that's really what you want, I think, because I think that movies are a director's medium, you know, and I think you have to be smart as a writer to go in and say, I'm now handing this off, and it's now going to be the piece that belongs to the director, and so that's why I love that we have a strong director, and hopefully this version is going to be getting made, but when? According to Tom, I know, I'm now very dispirited, it's taking a long time.
Oh, but Tom, okay, first of all, did you get treated badly, or will you not say?
No, so my experience on Little Children, say, was very much like Emma's, since I wrote it with the director, Todd Field, and when you do that, then you skip these layers of other people who get to take wax at your work. You're just, you know, Todd and I wrote it together, and he was able to say, this is the movie I want to make, and he had the ability to get it made.
Well, did you tell me once that even then it came out more dark than the dark comedy than you had written? Now, some people would say comedy, there was a pedophile in there, but yes, there were some laughs, but it came out darker.
Yes, and that was funny because Todd and I really adapted the book faithfully, but then this other thing happens in the editing room, and I wasn't there for that. That was his place, and the movie's long as it is, but we had to lose huge chunks of it. So, you know, we turned in a script that was very long, and he said, I just want to film it all, and then we'll edit it.
And how much do you have to let go? Because on the Leftovers series, again, if I've got this right, one of your characters, I think it was a sheriff, was a really nice guy.
He's a mayor in the
mayor,
book,
right.
Yeah.
And then he turns into this terrible guy.
He's
because
not
they
a terrible guy,
a terrible
but
guy.
he's a tormented guy, and he's not in the book. In The Leftovers, you know, once we turned the book into a series, and we have, in the end, we'll have 28 hours of story, and we used up the book in the first 10. So we've created an entirely, this organism outlived the book. It is its own thing, and actually I was much happier in the process once we left the book behind. It felt freer. I could be more part of a team. I didn't see my role as being, hey, wait a second, I've got a good idea. It's chapter 6 of the book. Once I could leave that behind, I felt like I was really part of the team and part of this collaborative effort, and that became really fun for me. But yes, I had to give up a lot, and some of that was just built into the medium, where HBO said, your character is too nice. That was their one note on the script. You know, there's this sort of cable brand, which is the tormented antihero. And they were incredibly free in terms of, you know, they allowed us to make a dark, complicated story and do anything we wanted. But they also had this sense of, like, our stories don't look like that. And so I had to, you know, I was willing to transform the story in that way.
Well, even when you were with the indie process, Emma, I think I read that you said that, well, first of all, you had to cut so much of Jack out because suddenly Ma comes to the...
So he's in every scene. I mean, it's actually a very child's eye film as films go.
But I mean, his
film
thoughts.
Doesn't have a totally strict point of view.
Well, I was reading, and again, maybe I have this wrong, but that you would say once it goes through the process of now it's even through an actor, that you would be watching and suddenly you don't know what that character is thinking, which is brand new for you because you always knew what Jack was thinking.
Well, novels are just very good at the psychology, and film is good at giving people bodies. So it seemed to me that, yes, we're giving up a lot, but we're getting a huge amount in exchange. So also the timing is so different. I mean, these are very basic differences, but books have time for just about anything. If you want to stick in, you know, 2 pages of social satire at some point, that's fine. There's room for everything. Whereas film, you have to be always so aware that your time is limited. And for instance, in the book, there's a moment of backstory where Jack finds out that his mother had a first baby who died. And in the book, I think I found the right moment to put that in. And we never officially wanted to cut it out of the film, but there was no right moment for it. In the editing, they kept fumbling around trying to find a moment, and everywhere they put it in, it felt like, you know, why suddenly this downer, you know, why this movement back towards the dark? So that was an example of the kind of thing that has to go, not because anyone says, let's cut the stillbirth, but for the rhythm of the film.
Yes.
So, I found it totally fascinating to go through the process and to see all the advantages film has, as well as all the advantages that fiction has.
Can I just stay with you for 1 second? I want to ask each of you about your books, but off the screenplay idea. But just in your case, having just finished The Wonder, which is a wonder. Again, there's sort of a likeness to it, completely different in so many ways, but a likeness in that there's a child in peril, and there's a woman, in the case of The Wonder, it's a nurse, who comes trying to... How do you live? It takes a long time to write a book. How do you live with children in peril?
Writing about depressing subjects doesn't depress me. It would depress me if the writing was going badly. But if I'm writing well about dark stuff, I'm like, yes, that was a good day. I made him suffer. I made him suffer in a way which hopefully will make my readers suffer too. Double score. You know? No, I know it's sounding callous, but we enjoy this stuff, you know?
Well, and Maria, in your case, it's women in peril.
Mm-hmm.
It's, and both... unless I've got this wrong, both formerly famous in some ways and kind of now, I'm sorry, but sort of stuck in Seattle. and I've been reading that they've come to embrace and love you in Seattle.
Yes.
Even though, kind of unraveling and you know, something you're plumbing there, maybe.
Yes, and I think I will probably always write about a woman my age who's kind of struggling with motherhood and being an artist, and it'll take place where I live, and Seattle hasn't kicked me out yet, so if they'll still have me, I might write my next book there. But yeah, I Emma's absolutely right it's interesting that if you're writing a sad scene, I don't think you're sad writing the sad scene. There's so much work to do to write the sad scene, and you're coming to it as a craftsman. You know, is the right information in the scene? Is the language right? Are the attitudes of the characters right? Am I laying it on too thick? And I mean, you're just making 1,000 decisions, and you're never. I feel like I'm never feeling what I'm writing exactly. I'm more just kind of clinically trying to get it across and make sure that it works properly on the page.
Is there ever a point, though, because I know when I'm, let's say I'm putting together a story, just to give a quick example, I am doing the same thing, you know, a few seconds here, a few seconds there, but then when I'm listening to it, if my heart is, as I'm listening, if my heart is going and about to burst, and then I know that there's a false moment because my heart stops bursting,
mm-hmm.
and I stop feeling like I want to cry. So I don't, I didn't do that. I didn't edit that well. Do you ever go back over it to see if it's then got the emotional pull that you were hoping for?
Very much so, and I think that that helps if you put it aside for a while, and it kind of takes you by surprise. You know, I will still, just in an insufferable way, tear up at my own writing. You know, which I hate to do in public, because God, look at her crying at her own writing. You know, but I think you, if you're doing it right, you are writing about something that's very meaningful to you, and if it takes you by surprise because. Like me, you forget everything, and then you read your book as if it's a new book. Then it can take you by surprise. So yeah, you definitely want that to be the result. But it's not like you need to, like an actor, channel and that emotion to be in the emotion to write it. I think I feel like much more, like I say, of a surgeon or a craftsman,
yeah.
or something while I'm in the process of doing it.
Yeah. And Tom, you've been mining the suburbs for a while now. what is it? I mean, where do you see the darkness and the comedy?
I don't know. I mean, that's always there. I will just add into this conversation,
yeah.
that I started out very much as a comic writer. And I used to even, you know, make myself laugh, you know, which is an embarrassing thing. But I would know it was great. If I could make myself laugh, that was great. And I think I often start out with a kind of intellectual approach to a book. And The Leftovers actually surprised me. I think I wanted to write about an apocalyptic story and... also comment on theological issues. And it wasn't until I was in it that I realized that every one of these characters was suffering from a terrible sense of grief and loss. And it actually took me by surprise. I don't think I would have voluntarily entered that world. I entered it through this more abstract intellectual door. Mm-hmm. And that book really took a toll on me. And I was very surprised and now it's been this 8-year chunk of my life where we've been doing it. And I think, you know, there were people who just couldn't watch the show because the first season was so dark and heavy. And I was surprised at how much it sort of, I had to wrestle with those emotions in a way that I hadn't fully expected. And I was glad to be done with it, but then I dove back into this other version. But I was sort of inoculated by then, but I did watch other people involved with it also struggle with how to play, how to write characters who are constantly in a state of bewilderment. And even some of the actors would talk about how difficult it was to inhabit that space. So sometimes I wish I could, and I'm, for most of my career, I have had that distance on my work, but I think that book was the one exception. As for the suburbs, I think I'm like Maria in that I've just spent my life there, so that's where life takes place, and life is full of all this stuff. And I am just writing about the place that I know, and yeah. I'm kind of tracking my own life, so that I started out writing about, I wrote my sort of coming of age book, and then I wrote about, these young guys in their 20s, and then I started to write about young parents, and then older parents, and now I'm writing my sort of empty nest novel. So, you can look forward to my exposé of the nursing home. It's coming.
Emma, I wanted to ask you, all of you actually, weigh in on this. So much of good writing is being in someone's interior life. And yet film, the expressive actors, can communicate a lot, but it's dialogue, it's what they're saying. You don't get the nurse in The Wonder who, the running dialogue in her head about the people in the Catholic Church who, ferociously believe that this child is a miracle. You don't get her running dialogue. If that were to go to a screen, you'd have to communicate that some way. And Maria, in the case of Eleanor, you don't get her constant running dialogue about, there's one part where she talks about her head is such a fuzzy haze of things that she's trying to do that she lists the things that she's decided not to pay attention to. I'm trying to think, transgender issues. Do you remember the list? Because she's...
The location of the stolen paintings from the Isabella Center. And Lena Dunham.
Lena Dunham. Yeah.
Just things she's chosen, made an executive decision to have no interest in.
Right, because she has no room. She's wrangling a child and a life in Seattle and changing her jobs and everything, and she just lists this. I would hate to see a film that had all a narrator saying those things. We're told that means you've done a bad screenplay. But what do you worry about losing those interior lives?
I think film can suggest interior life. It just doesn't pin it down. I loved that about making the film of Room, that there were moments when I'm looking at Bree's face or Jacob's face, our child, and you don't know exactly what they're thinking, but you're hugely intrigued. So there's a certain mysteriousness to it that sometimes fiction can lack. In fiction, we have a tendency to spell everything out. So in a way, film can pull back on that and be very bare and spare sometimes. And the actors manage to make it so engrossing that even if you couldn't specify what's going through their minds, you can't take your eyes off them.
Yeah.
Did you, in any of your drafts, try it with voiceover?
I at first had no voiceover at all because I so wanted to avoid it sounding like adapted from the best-selling novel. You know, like I hate those films that start with 2 minutes of portentous voiceover about the summer I was 10, I learned an important lesson, So I used no voiceover at all.
Tom started that way.
But then Lenny, our director, asked me for some voiceover, but he said, I promise I'll use it really sparingly just to kind of mark the sections, just as a rhythmic device almost. And he said also, don't give me any voiceover that explains what Jack is feeling in that scene. We always want them to be in slightly different directions. So, for instance, when he suddenly thinks his mother's going to die, we used a voiceover where he's talking about aliens and angels and so on. He's commenting in a slightly spacey way on time and space. So it was never like, I'm feeling extra super sad.
Right.
You know. So basically, he reassured me by saying we can use voiceover, but not to just fill in what film can't do as well as books.
Right.
Like, this is not a book.
How about the difference between arm wrestling a novel to the ground by yourself and working on a team? You've worked on television shows. The solitary versus the teamwork.
Oh, well, you know, so I've had every level of this. Like, with Election, I just handed over a manuscript to Alexander Payne and his writing partner, Jim Taylor, and they made this amazing movie. Then with Todd, he and I collaborated on the script, but I wasn't part of the production or the editing. But on the TV show, I've been in the room, you know, even at this point where we're beyond the book, and, you know, I'm working as a producer, and so involved in things like casting and, to some degree, post-production editing. And that was a really interesting and, in the end, very wonderful experience, though I will say the first year was really hard because it was mine. But I wasn't the showrunner. I don't know how to make a show. And we were lucky enough to get Damon Lindelof, the guy who is responsible for Lost. He was running the show, and he's a very strong personality and a very distinctive writer. And he had his own ideas about the book and about the concept. And I think he saw it as his job to make it his show. And so the first year was this, I think, real push and pull between us. And I understood, like, I volunteered to be here. I volunteered to be part of this team. My job can't be to simply defend the book. But I didn't. But I also sometimes felt like, I'm giving you this, or I'm giving this up, you know? And the experience got much better for me once I lost that feeling. I felt like the show had taken on a life of its own, and we were creating something that belonged to all of us. And that was actually a really interesting corrective, not corrective, but just a midlife change for me. I had been writing alone in my room for, you know, 20-some years. And it was just really interesting to have a workplace to go to and, you know, colleagues to deal with, some of whom I love, some of whom, you know, we have complicated relations with. But it felt like a very rich experience for me.
Does it ever feel like selling out?
You know what? I have never had that feeling about the films I made. And part of it was that when I got into the movie business, it was on the indie end, where I'm very proud of them. I never felt like I made something just to make money. I always felt like I was involved in.
And you didn't care what they did with it. I mean, if you Google, there's titles of articles, Hollywood Ate My Book, and things like that,
yeah.
You know, where people feel like, oh my God, I'm embarrassed about what happened.
Yeah, no, so I always felt like I was involved in storytelling as, you know, as well as I could do it. Whether it was in writing a book or making a film or a TV show.
Yeah. And I know you are in development hell right now, but I'm wondering with the new book, I wanted to ask you, Maria, about an aspect of the new book that I told you that I thought was just, I mean, there's hilarity ensues.
Yes.
As we expect in the book, it's just fabulously scattered and this woman is just cray cray sometimes, you know. But then, boom, we're in a story about her being the child of an alcoholic and the relationship with her sister. And we literally go to a whole other book within the book.
Yes.
Which is fabulous and sad and compelling. It made me anxious.
Hmm.
Talk about that. I mean, that, as much as you want to, was that like personal to you? And I'm wondering if what happens if you ever want to hand that book over to somebody, because it feels, that nugget of it in particular feels very personal.
And self-contained. Well, that was really a solution to what I felt might have been a problem with the first-person narration, is that Eleanor Flood in the book really comes on strong in the beginning of the book. It's really a strong voice. And there's kind of a method to the madness as the book progresses. You see that she's really turning it on thick, and perhaps the reader doesn't quite isn't quite aware of how manipulated they are being by her. And so what I, because I didn't want to back off on her voice, I felt like we needed some breathers from her voice every now and then. And so I put a graphic novel in about a third of the way through.
Yeah, there's a whole graphic novel in the novel.
Right. And I hired an illustrator, a wonderful guy named Eric Anderson, and he did a graphic novel for me. That also was to take a break from Eleanor's voice in the beginning when it was coming on really strong. And then I did want to really to challenge myself, drop in a third person narration from a very distant perspective where on the one hand, the rest of the book takes place over the course of one day and is told by a very opinionated, intense narrator. I wanted to then do 40 pages in the middle of the book that span 50 years with a very removed narrator and just have a completely different emotional experience. And at first when I thought about that, I thought, I don't have the writing talent to do that. Like people who get stories in The New Yorker can write that way and I can't. And so somehow that was a throwdown to myself to step up and write that. But I love that section. And yes, it is self-contained. It's not... I don't think I'm glad that you think it's personal. It's actually not that personal, but I'm glad it feels that way because some of the really root emotions are, you know, but I built an entire world that really I don't have a connection with. It takes place in New Orleans and I'd never been down there. I flew down there for a few days just to learn about the city and I wrote about it from an outsider's point of view, which helped the narrative.
Well, by the way, that gauntlet you threw down yourself, you nailed it. I mean, it just is really quite something.
Thank you.
And as you were writing that about Eleanor Flood, were you thinking of who would play her? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. I think you've been told that's the most annoying question, and yet you step in our trap.
I'm kidding.
You know what's weird is I really don't. I'd be interested if Emma and Tom feel this way, but I actually have a very strong picture in my mind of my heroines, and they are not... movie stars. Like, I actually can picture them. If I could probably give them to a police sketch artist and draw who I'm imagining them to be, but they're not people I know and they're not actresses, but I visualize them very vividly.
Do you? We'll end on that.
Mine don't always have very particular faces. I know their minds, you know, mm-hmm. I know the flavor of their minds, yeah, but I don't much mind, you know, which faces get attached to them.
Wow.
But certainly when I'm writing a book, the last thing I would be thinking about is a film because I want to play up the strengths of the medium I'm working in. And, you know, a book is so entirely satisfying on its own. And one of the things, just to get back to, you know, the pros and cons of the two different lifestyles of working as a writer, I couldn't possibly ever work full-time in film because it stops and starts for reasons which are nothing to do with how well you've written. I would just find that so frustrating. Would like be being a child again, you know, just told you can't have summer holidays till the end of June, you know. Mm-hmm. When you're writing a novel, you generate it, you push it forward, you know, it's so satisfying that way. Whereas film is enormously collaborative and fun and stimulating and there are, you know, lunches and so on. But the stopping and starting would kill me.
Well, we're going to end on that note. Emma Donahue, Tom Parada, Maria Semple, because we want to have questions from the audience. But I can't say enough, if you haven't read all three of the latest novels from these three authors, you are in for such a treat. You will not be leaving the house. Thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
And I see we have our microphone here. We have about 20 minutes, perhaps maybe a little less, because we have books in the back, and the authors are going to scurry down there, and then you can have books signed. But we have a microphone here. If you have any questions for our, as I've said, Frappin all-star lineup of authors here, don't be shy.
We won't insult the question, we promise.
Well, if somebody's... Okay, well, then you have to go to the microphone. I know. Are you in the witness protection program? I'm sorry. You do have to. There we go.
I was just wondering, so many times good books are, all kinds of books are made into movies. Why do you think that movies aren't ever made into books?
They are.
Are they?
Well, they're novelized. And so.
But yes, why do we wince at the word? It's true. Yeah. Why does the adaptation process only seem respectable when it's going that way? Good question.
Well, I think it's who's going to be the voice of the novel when it goes from the screen to the novel. Like it's such an individual's vision, and it's such an act of self-will on the part of one person to get a novel written that I don't know who would take the responsibility and who would even have that inner fire, you know, to actually get a novel written. I mean, if it was a proper novel and not a novelization, let's say.
And just to be very basic, a novel has a lot more words in it. So I suppose we'd be distrustful of why have they added words to something that was good already? Whereas with film, we can quite see why, for practical purposes, you have to carve things down.
Yeah,
but that is an interesting,
thought-provoking. And I think we have someone else.
Well, I think it also related to a time when you couldn't see the movie over and over again.
Mm.
So you had an experience that you really valued, but it wasn't available.
To take it
and so,
home. Yeah.
You know, you could
spend more time with it.
Yeah, you could re-experience it that way, but now you don't have to do it.
That's why I'm in love with the young adult films that come off of the series books, and because they're getting younger people to read,
mm-hmm.
because they might see the film and then read the book, or read the book in anticipation of the film. Yes.
Great. Thank you. Tom, I've been a big fan since I was 19. I read Joe College during lunch break mowing lawns. So my question is basically, you know, right now I read and hear more about how Hollywood is, and the motion picture is taking kind of more of a back seat to longer scripted HBO series and Netflix series. Amazon has their own channel. How much do you think, you know, novels and books will now not be translated to the silver screen, but more so longer series, six-part series, the scripted miniseries and such?
I think it's already happening. I know I just talked to Todd Field the other night, and he's doing an adaptation with Jonathan Franzen of Purity for Showtime. There are many other, because I think, you know, it's very rare now to get a book of the literary quality of Room, you know, made into a feature film. You know, but Hollywood wants to make the big blockbuster movies that they can sell overseas, and you know, small dramas are—it's just hard. Whereas, it does seem like there's a real audience for long-form TV, and novels are a great source for that. I think, you know, The Leftovers was unusual because we didn't just adapt the book; we kind of used the world of it to create this bigger series, and so it was sort of interesting in that way. Maybe you'll see more of that, and maybe you'll see more just miniseries, you know, 6 or 8 hours, which might be really perfect for adapting a novel, because
mm-hmm.
you talked about how much you had to lose
right.
in Bernadette. But if you have 5 or 6 hours rather than 2 hours, you can really adapt.
Wait, there's always been a mismatch between the novel and the feature film, because feature films are a perfect adaptation of a short story, say something like Brokeback Mountain. But most novels, you know, have to be horribly squeezed to fit into the feature film. So maybe novel and miniseries are really, maybe that's the ideal kind
of match. I'm hoping this could be a great time for novels, because you've got Amazon and you've got all these places. Everybody's looking for content.
Yes, well, they're starving for content.
Right.
Well, the other thing is, we had a couple writers on our show this year who had gone to Iowa to the Writers' Workshop
for,
to be fiction writers.
Yeah.
And they were saying, like, everybody in Iowa now wants to go to Hollywood and work, because you get out of an MFA program and it's like, what do I do? You know, you go and
write novels.
Well, it
come
is.
Come on, people.
But you got to make a living. You got to make a living. I taught composition.
Okay.
I wish I was in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to Tom's point earlier about the cable profile of the protagonist, you know, the complex characters, I think that is novelistic. I remember when I was writing for TV, everything was about making the characters sympathetic. You know, we need all the characters to have the victory in each episode. You know, they all need to be nice to each other. And it was just, everything was nice. These are all your friends that you want to come home to after a long day at work, you know, and you don't want anything negative in it. And so I think that TV has obviously changed over the years radically, in that you do want the complex anti-heroes, and novels are not just about nice, happy people shooting the breeze. You know, they are much more complex, you know, so I think that this is why it is starting to sync up.
Yeah. Great question. Do we have one more? And then I'm going to ask one last one myself. Oh, we have two more.
Mm-hmm. I'm a minister, so I really picked up on the theological themes in both Wonder and Leftovers. But I'm curious about all three authors. Are those hard things to interest publishers or filmmakers in? I mean, it's thrilling to read these themes in your work. And I also wonder if film allows you to do things that writing does not when addressing these topics, theology, spirituality, religion.
I don't think that my publishers were scared off by the religious themes in The Wonder, but it makes it a bit tricky in doing publicity because sometimes people want to ask all about your beliefs, and that's the last thing I'd want to talk about. I'd rather discuss my sex life than my religious life. But also, people's feelings can be hurt. You know, I said something in last night's talk that I gave about Catholicism, and somebody in the audience threw her arm up and was clearly offended. So it's a very touchy subject. But it's life and death stuff. I mean, it's at least, you know, there's no danger that people wouldn't care at all about what you're saying. So I think it's good meaty stuff.
Damn, I was going to ask you about both your sex life and your religion. That was going to be my wrap-up question. Thank you. We have one more, I think.
That's okay. So this is kind of a question for Tom, but also related to what Maria was saying. Robin, when I heard you say that I think Kevin was kind of a terrible character in The Leftovers, I thought, I don't think of him that way. I think of him as, in the book, a man who was trying to make tough moral decisions on a small domestic scale, but then in a movie, you kind of have to blow up his moral choices into a dramatic scale, but he's still trying to be a decent human being. And I was just wondering for all of you guys about showing the complexity of moral decision-making, but on the big screen, and how does that work?
Well, on a whole different film, just recently, there was a long piece about election that was in New York Magazine, and it was relating it to this particular election. And people were saying, you know, watching the film now, it felt so different. People thought it was funny, and they hated Tracy in the past. That was how it started out. And now people are watching it through a much more explicitly feminist lens. You know, the culture has changed a lot. And the Matthew Broderick character, who had seemed somewhat like a hapless but sympathetic loser, suddenly seemed like this predatory older man. And it was just very interesting for me to...
He's the teacher.
Yeah. And it was just very interesting for me to see, like, you know, over time, how these things had changed and how even the likability of characters shifted depending upon the political context in which it happened. So, and I actually felt good about that as a writer. I thought that the fact that these characters can be seen in very different ways depending upon the context in which you read them suggested that there was some truth in their behavior and that they were compounds of, you know, sympathetic impulses and terrible impulses. And it just, you know, depending upon the way that you look at it, you might see it in different ways. So, I that's kind of the goal for me is not so much a lovable character, but a character who is struggling with some of the moral issues that a lot of us are struggling with.
Yeah. Anyone else want to weigh in? Well, I think that will be the last word, and just in time. Again, Emma Donahue, Room and the Wonder, Tom Perata, his The Leftovers is out in paperback. Maria Semple, Today Will Be Different, Where'd You Go, Bernadette? We're going to wait for that movie when it comes.
It's going to happen.
Thank you all so much. Thank you so much for coming. The books will be signed and sold in the back, and let the book festival begin. Thank you so much.